authority to go around Congress to issue this relief, which he says would delay evictions, payroll taxes, and student loan payments, and extend unemployment benefits, though the amount would not be the $600 a week the Democrats want.
The U.S. Post Office has a money crisis amid the pandemic, but its leader, Louis DeJoy, says it is not shutting down election mail as the primary looms. CBS's Nancy Cordes says some lawmakers are calling for a probe.
They argue that the new Postmaster General, who is a big donor to President Trump, has a personal stake in competitors to the Postal Service, private companies. They say he and his wife have millions of dollars in assets in those companies, and they want to know whether any of that has affected some of his recent decisions.
The nation's eyes are on Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden and his choice of a running mate. CBS's Ed O'Keefe says Biden is still vetting candidates, including Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who has been to see him.
Biden stayed close to his Delaware home Friday as his team remains tight-lipped about who he might choose as a running mate. A formal announcement is expected next week.
The National Weather Service confirms a tornado hit Connecticut earlier this week, this during Tropical Storm Isaias. Most of Westport lost power and many there are still in the dark. The storm killed at least 9 people in the U.S. alone. Turning now to Beirut, where there's public anger and people are demanding the government take responsibility for that deadly blast that killed more than 150 people.
Residents of this shattered city are taking to the streets in major anti-government protests. They're calling a day of judgment for their leaders. They blame for this devastation.
The rage on Beirut's ruined streets runs deep. And these running street battles between protesters and security forces exposes a hard truth, that the city's citizens haven't just lost everything, they've lost complete faith in their leaders, and their fury is now bottomless.
That's correspondent MTS Tayyab. Some 5,000 people were injured in that blast. This is CBS News.
The biggest names in politics face the questions you want answered.
As Commander-in-Chief, what do you think America's role in the world should be?
Face the Nation, Sundays on CBS.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language like French, Spanish, or Russian, but thought it would be too difficult and time-consuming? Then go to Babbel.com and try it for free. Babbel works because it's built around real life. It teaches you everyday practical conversations that you will actually use. In 15 minutes a day, you'll be on your way to speaking a new language in just a few weeks. Babbel uses a modern conversation-based technique that makes language engaging, fun, and memorable. It starts by teaching you words and phrases. Then, sentences gradually get more complex. Soon, you're practicing short conversations about real-life topics. Babbel is created by language experts who use the spaced repetition method to help you learn quickly and remember what you learned. With Babbel, you can speak a new language. Babbel, language for life. Now try Babbel for free. Just go to Babbel.com and start learning a new language today. That's Babbel.com. Babbel.com.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. In the studio this morning, we have Mike Stories, who's a local attorney who helps to defend law enforcement when needed. And on the telephone, we have journalist Chuck Holton, who is a war correspondent and has been covering the riots in Portland and Seattle. Chuck, can you hear me?
I hear you.
Oh,
it's
cool.
Good to talk to you.
You too. Tell me, where are you right now?
I'm in West Virginia. We have a vacation home there.
Oh, okay, good. You're on vacation and I'm putting you to work. Here you go.
Okay.
I posted the videos on our website, lawmatters1030.org. If you go to podcasts and scroll down a tad, you'll see the videos of the riots. And I did that to avoid any censorship or, you know, rules that we might have to follow so people can hear it in its entirety. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing?
Well, I spent the last week, I guess 2 weeks ago now, in Portland and in Seattle, covering the riots that were taking place there. And I tell you what, I've not been tear gassed so many times in one week in my entire life. But I think I'm starting to get a taste for it now. it was really amazing to see the lack of coverage from the mainstream media during the height of these riots. I was checking CNN's website, MSNBC's website, absolutely nothing on there about the riots. Not one mention of it. But yet I ran into journalists from three different Russian media outlets on the ground there. I ran into some journalists from Portugal, journalists from, I think, Germany or someplace. So there were a lot of foreign coverage there, but very little, and a lot of local coverage, but very little actual mainstream media coverage of the riots.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that they're starting to understand that this kind of chaos on the streets of America is going to pertain to one party or the other. People are going to look at it and say that's because of either the Republicans or that's because of the Democrats, and so whichever one they lay blame on will suffer in November. And I think that especially in Portland, it was a very overt attack against Donald Trump. They were attacking this large federal building, this federal courthouse. Well, you know, that courthouse never did anything to them. Why would they be doing that? People don't do things for no reason. Why attack that building? Well, that building's been there for decades, since the 1970s. So the reason, when you ask the rioters why they're doing it, they were at that building was a proxy for Donald Trump. And they were attacking Donald Trump by attacking the building. So it's kind of hard for voters, if they were to get that story, to lay blame on the Republicans for the attacks, because they're actually attacking Donald Trump.
So one of my questions was, and I brought it up earlier, is at what point is this just domestic terrorism?
Well, I don't think there's any question that it is domestic terrorism. I've heard somebody say just this morning that authority without power is weakness, and power without authority is anarchy. And when you have 3,000 Antifa rioters taking over square blocks of downtown Portland every night for 2 months, that's power without any authority. But they want the authority. They say they want to get rid of the police. That's not really true. They don't want to get rid of the police so much as they want to become the police. And you can see that in their tactics. They have units that are designated among the Antifa rioters to block off streets. They have bicycles and motorcycles and cars that they park every night. They come down and they park them around the courthouse so that police cars cannot get in there. They have medics that are designated to you know, help any riders that get hurt by the tear gas or whatever. They have attack units, support units, and they coordinate everything with these expensive military-grade radios. They've got shields and lots of field expedient weapons, and they are. I was told many times, stop filming. You can't film here. You can only film there. You have to go here. You can't be over here. You know, they have no authority to tell a journalist where he can and cannot film on a public street. But they try to take that authority and use it, wield it in a very authoritarian way. So it's these people are beyond irony. I mean, it's ironic that they say that they are against fascism, and yet they're using fascist practices and techniques. It's ironic that they're against authoritarianism, but they are instituting their own form of violent authoritarianism every night down there. And they're using, as you can see from the videos that have come out just in the last few days, of them assaulting elderly women, stopping vehicles, breaking, you know, bashing cars, vandalizing houses, residential areas. These are not the actions of principled protesters. These are the actions of violent anarchists who don't want anarchy. They just want to be in control. I heard somebody say they don't. They could care less about the whole Black Lives Matter, George Floyd thing, although they try to pretend that they're operating under that banner. They don't want to take the knee off of George Floyd's neck. They want to become the knee on George Floyd's neck, and it's very clear by their actions.
Some of the assaults that I saw in the videos, and there's several of them if you go underneath the video itself next to Chuck's name, there's a link where you can push and you'll see several videos that were given to us by him. These are his videos. Some of the things that I saw, the way they were attacking law enforcement, and that's why I have Mike Stories in the studio here to talk about what does law enforcement, what are their rights? Because they're having bottles of liquids thrown at them, that flammable liquids, and these people are throwing, yep, you know, fireworks at them, lit fireworks, feces, and lasers. They're using lasers to try to, you know, injure them. What is law enforcement? What is their side of this? Yes, Mike.
Well, good morning, Sherry. I mean, it's a difficult, ever-changing sort of scenario, because what Chuck was describing is very very organized tactics by these groups, where I think before you found it was a random sort of more organic gathering of people, and there wasn't such a tactical plan going into these things, which makes it difficult for law enforcement, obviously. And so their tactics have to be ever-changing. The things that I've seen in Tucson is, you know, police have their tactics, they practice for these things, but they, you know, the typical gatherings in Tucson arise from, like, you recall, the U of A basketball team wins a championship, or they lose in this round or whatever.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the students are pouring out and people are pouring out of bars, and there it happens. And, yeah, and these are very sort of haphazard situations. And when that happens, the drama comes when a drunk person will come behind the skirmish line, for instance. And you can't have that. You can't have people behind the police as they're advancing. And someone will get pushed, it'll be a girl, it'll be on video, and all of a sudden there's a big hubbub. So that's sort of the times that I have to jump in. And even recently, there's been another incident. So, you know, what Chuck's describing is much more alarming.
No, because it's very organized. You know, U of A winning or losing a thing, it's just like it happened.
Right.
There's no organization, right, about it. But these people are walking around with assault rifles, and, you know, intimidating, and it's not cool what's going on now.
It is evolving night by night as the police evolve their tactics. It's a cat and mouse game, without a doubt. And I think because of the feckless response, not just a feckless response by the city government, but outright approval, without a doubt. I mean, Ted Wheeler came down in Portland one night. I was there and literally stood up in front of the group and said, "I am with you 100%. I am with you all the way." And he wasn't just talking to the protesters. He was talking to the rioters, because he went over and joined the rioters after he said that. And he's the police commissioner of Portland. He's the top law enforcement official in Portland. And he was standing there watching multiple felonies take place in front of that courthouse as they were attempting to burn down the courthouse, as they were throwing firebombs at the federal agents, as they were, you know, burning trash and trying to tear down the fence and the walls around the courthouse. You know, graffiti. I could go on and on and on. I mean, you could just see felony after felony taking place. And he stood there and watched it all, and was in 100% agreement. Now they've the president threatened to send in the National Guard, and I think again these politicians are starting to realize that this is really not going as well as they thought it would from a political standpoint. And so now, yesterday, Ted Wheeler came out with a very scathing statement against the rioters that he had pledged to support only a few days before. So these people are evolving their tactics, but not just in the strategic or tactical realm, they have a strategy that goes deep into the information battle space. Every night when they come down there, they are planning for how this is going to look on the news tomorrow. How is this going to play in the news? And so one night they brought down the quote-unquote wall of moms. Now, most of these moms were women who had been down there for many nights before rioting alongside the Antifa guys. They were all part of Antifa, but they just put on yellow shirts and put flowers on and stuff. And the way I know that they were the same people is that they all kept their same gas masks and helmets that they had been wearing from previous nights. But they went down and they linked arms in front of the courthouse and said, "We will not allow these federal goons to hurt the poor rioters that are just here trying to, make a statement with their protest." And then Antifa used that wall of moms as a shield, human shields, and then from behind them started launching gasoline bombs and projectiles and fireworks over their heads into the courthouse square. And to the point where the federal agents had to come out and put the fires out. And when they do that, they have to throw tear gas to push the crowds back, or else they will literally get killed. Those guys, I mean, I heard Antifa rioters say, literally, it's okay to kill these guys. They're just uniforms. That's all they are. They're just uniforms. Wow. They're not people. I heard them say that. I have it on tape. And so, I mean, the strange thing is the only people I saw that were trying to get them to stop were black people who were up there in front saying, "Guys, this is not helping. This is not helping the Black Lives Matter cause." And they got shouted down, and in one case, the guy got stabbed.
Jeez. Wow. I know on one of the tapes, I heard somebody, they said, "Who are you with? Who are you with?" And then finally somebody said, "The KKK." And, yeah. You know, I don't know if they were with the KKK or if they were just, you know, saying that, but it was just like some of the verbiage that's used too when they're describing different things on the news. And you don't really see all this on the news, but when it is on the news, I know Peter Thompson on ABC News described a photo by referring to law enforcement as racist police. Instead of saying, you know, law enforcement, this is what happened. Right. Racist police.
We've heard federal goons. We've heard stormtroopers used by the top politicians in our country. And this is absolutely out beyond the pale. This is absolutely wrong. Those guys took an oath to protect the Constitution of the United States. This is just exactly like if you were to call, if Nancy Pelosi were to call our troops in Afghanistan stormtroopers, there's no difference. These guys lay their lives on the line every night and are, in fact, seeing much more dangerous situations than our troops that are overseas that I have been with recently, because they can't shoot back.
Yeah.
You think about that. These cops they have such restrictive rules of engagement. If somebody in that crowd of 3,000 protesters opens fire on them with an AK-47, what can they do? If they shoot back, they're shooting into a crowd of mostly unarmed people.
Mike, what do you think? Chuck, love it. I want to hear what Mike has to say about it, because I think, you know, at some point, you know, this is self-defense has to kick in at some point. Mike, what would you say is lawful and unlawful, and how do you move forward from this mess?
Well, you know, I don't. Chuck had his, you know, feet on the ground observing this stuff. Obviously, we were not there. I think the scenario that you put out there, someone fires an AK at the cops, that would be amazingly horrible, you know, and that would actually, I think, as bad a scenario as it is, would swing some sympathy towards the cops, because I think these groups are smarter than to do something like that. They push it just enough that, you know, people aren't outraged by their tactics, seemingly. But something like that would be such a crazy, because you're right. I mean, you know, what do we see in the Middle East? We see terrorists hiding behind innocents, you know, where, you know, our poor troops can't, you know, respond the way they should. that's the scenario you're painting, which is just, you know, it would be tragic if that happened.
Horrific.
Yeah. But again, I think it would swing the pendulum a little more towards, wait a minute, these cops, these are not just bottles in this, because people see them geared up in these riot gear and they think they're impregnable. They're not, you know, and yet, so bottles thrown at them, as you describe, you know, fireworks, they just think, well, you know, they're prepared for this. It's peaceful until it becomes deadly, you know. But
they've had more than 270 office federal agents injured in 60 days of protesting in Portland. 270 injuries. And we're talking everything from burns to contusions to concussions, you name it. And, you know, some of them have been permanently blinded by these green lasers that these guys have been fond of using. And so, again, what, like, that, I think that is the most pertinent question here. Legally, from a legal standpoint, what is the right response from the federal government when you're talking about these massive numbers of people?
I guess it's what they're willing, what the public is willing to accept. And as you, right, you know, as you rightly point out, everything is polarized right now. So two people describing the same incident are describing it totally different. I suspect that what's going on, I think, is a little influenced by what we have read has been going on in Hong Kong for months and months. And it has sort of turned into a tactic, counter-tactic out there with very few injuries. And it almost seemed interesting to the American people how that went on for months. Every night, you know, office people would be working all day, then they would take the bus with their masks and shirts in their backpacks. They would mobilize and they would have tactics, and it became an ongoing situation that I'm suspecting sort of influenced what's going on now, because I don't think we've ever seen such a you know, driven, constant you know, effort has been going on.
Yeah, it seems like it's very organized, and it's kind of scary, but it's not being covered by the mainstream media, like you said. We need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Hang on with us. Law Matters Live Show airs Saturday mornings at 8 when our listeners ask questions of people who have answers. On our next show, Sheriff Mark Napier talks to you about riots, protests, police reform, and the upcoming election. This is your show, Arizona, so get your questions ready to join the talk at 790-2040. You don't want to be left out. Set your alarm for AM 1030 The Voice. And we can't do the show without your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute.
To report suspected human trafficking, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to 233-733. To learn more about Homeland Security investigations and our efforts to combat human trafficking, please visit our website at www.ice.gov or check out the DHS Blue Campaign at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. For more information on the Southern Arizona Anti-Trafficking Unified Response Network, please visit us at www.saturn.org or find us on Facebook.
Getting a reverse mortgage with the new rules and expanded limits can be a positive, life-changing experience. The reverse offers multiple ways of having your equity work for you, from a monthly income, an interest-bearing equity account, or total cash out. Give me a call and let's see which reverse option best works for your future plans. Call 520-310-9900. Ask for me, Sherry. That's 520-310-9900.
With monsoon season well underway, the Tucson Fire Department would like you to keep these tips in mind on how to stay safe. Turn around, don't drown. Driving through a mere 8 inches of water can move your vehicle and cause you to be swept away. When thunder roars, head indoors. When you see that lightning flash and hear thunder, you need to drop what you're doing and head inside. When in doubt, wait it out. Save your errands for after storms have passed through your area. Remember, Tucson Fire is here for you. Stay safe.
Okay, we're back. Chuck, are you still with me? He went on vacation.
I'm with you.
Oh.
No, I'm with you. The music was so loud I couldn't hear you over it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's John's fault, not mine. So One of the things that I wanted to talk about, some of the arrests that were made in some of these incidents that people are up in arms about, a lot of these people have been found afterwards that they had illegal drugs in their system. And I know illegal drugs or any kind of drugs, people have different reactions. Sometimes they're, you know, like a happy drunk. Sometimes they're a belligerent drunk. Well, fentanyl and methamphetamine and things like that can make people do different things. Now, we've had law enforcement guys fired and dismissed, some without even the benefit of a trial or an investigation, because of something that happened with somebody who was on drugs. Doesn't the family, Mike, doesn't the family hold some responsibility? They know they've got a family member who's on drugs and not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Don't they hold some responsibility for not doing an intervention or trying to get that person help?
Well, I think that would be great. But if there was a recent example, I think maybe you're talking about, there was an in-custody death involving someone who was on drugs. And this is an adult, you know, who basically is on their own, running around doing their thing. And sometimes these things are uncontrollable. And in fact, in that situation, not only were they not able to control it, but they called law enforcement to help them control their own family member. Because that particular call, this guy is wrecking his grandmother's house and he won't leave and he won't let her leave. So she calls law enforcement to come help. And when they come help, they're faced with that situation, like you said, of someone who is on these type of drugs that make people, you know, irrational, strong beyond their appearance, and you know, it's a very dangerous situation, and that's what happened here.
Well, I think that happens in a lot of cases. I know Mr. Floyd, and I don't agree with what happened to him, but he was on fentanyl and methamphetamine. There was another one, Michael Brown. Everybody was like, oh, Michael Brown. He was on drugs, too. I mean, you do things that you normally wouldn't be doing when you're on drugs. And I don't see how you can hold law enforcement responsible for somebody taking drugs. They didn't put the drug in their system. They didn't encourage that type of behavior. They're trying to stop it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, where we cross the line, maybe in the Floyd case, is once again, they're faced with a potentially dangerous situation and police are trained how to deal with that. They did not, the officers did not act, you know, per training and sort of per normal procedures nationwide.
Right.
But, you know, there's an old law axiom that says bad facts make bad law. And so what you have there is bad facts, no question. But it turns into bad policy nationwide, and it turns into bad, you know, sort of lump sum, you know, conclusions and knee-jerk reactions, which hurt law enforcement.
And there's been a lot of knee-jerk reactions going on.
Oh, totally. And like Chuck is talking about with these, what's going on in Portland, what it's done is sort of taken the teeth away from law enforcement as far as what would be acceptable force, and they're all under such microscopes now that even their commanders and the officers themselves are afraid to do anything.
Yeah.
And probably Chuck has seen that, you know, out there.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I think that you have three different spheres that they have to live in as a law enforcement officer. You live in the legal sphere, the moral sphere, and the political sphere. And then, you know, what you're doing could be absolutely 100% justified by your organization's policy. It could be justified legally. It could be justified morally. But it doesn't matter anymore because the politics trump all. And so even if you do everything right, you could still have your life ruined. You could end up in jail. Your family's life's ruined, and you got to wonder how many cops are looking at that and saying, okay, wait, why would I do this again?
Right. And I will tell you anecdotally, I have very active police officers who I know, who I talk with, who say, I just don't chase calls anymore. Because yeah, every time I answer a call, it's another potential. And with the body-worn cameras, which, you know, okay, I see the utility of them, but it literally, you know, puts everything they do under a microscope.
And that's only a bird's eye view of, or a small view of what's going on, that body camera. It doesn't show the big picture. None of them have.
No, I mean, that's a whole different subject that's, you know, that it's not the panacea everybody thought it was going to be. I'll just say that, you know. But to Chuck's point, I think, you know, we have a situation here in Tucson, this in-custody death that I was talking about before. That happened in late April. That was investigated very thoroughly, the way they do. They call out their, you know, internal affairs, their criminal people, everything. No one had an issue with that incident for a month. Then George Floyd happened.
Until the charge.
All of a sudden, like Chuck said, the politics changed. And so what became a maybe training issue, maybe we do this a little better, different, whatever, all of a sudden became outrage after Floyd. And these officers, you know, we want their heads.
Okay, the training. Are they trained? When I watched what happened to George Floyd, I was horrified. I couldn't believe, what I really couldn't believe was that officer standing there not pushing him away, saying, get off his neck. And that's something that, you know, it's common sense. It's common sense. But is that a tactic that they're trained to do, is kneel on somebody's neck or their chest?
No, heck no. I mean, for 20 plus years, I've been responding to critical incidents which involve officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths, which we're talking about. One of my first questions always when I meet with the officer is, did you have any contact with their neck area to impede their breathing? That's first and foremost. And we all know that's a no-no. Now, what I found interesting in Minneapolis was they made this big thing about, we changed policy as a result of George Floyd, two new policies. One, no more chokeholds. Two, if an officer sees another officer doing something they have a problem with, they are to intervene. TPD, these are like part of the Ten Commandments.
Right.
And have been since I've been involved with them.
Right.
The fact that
I would say they probably have been for every police.
Oh, it's insane to me. I read this and I go, two new policies. I'm thinking, where have you been?
Exactly.
You know? I mean, exactly. So
Well, and again, now this is becoming one of those narratives, like we saw with Michael Brown. They are to this day, these rioters and protesters are running around with signs with pictures of Michael Brown on them that say, hands up, don't shoot. That narrative has been 100% completely debunked. Michael Brown did not have his hands up, was not asking not to be shot. He was in the act of attacking a police officer when he was shot. So that's a false narrative. And I think we have to be careful. Either we make truth our central focus, or we make politics our central focus, but we really can't do both. And in the case of George Floyd, as horrific as that video was, as terrible as the situation ended up being, you know, just for, you know, something crazy like trying to pass a fake check or whatever, this guy ends up dying. When the more evidence that comes out, the more it's starting to look like this narrative is another hands up, don't shoot narrative. Because if you read the autopsy report, he was not asphyxiated. He was not choked out. He was not choked to death. He died of heart failure that had to do with the fentanyl that was in his system. He very likely would have died anyway. He had enough drugs in his system to kill him before they went hands on with this guy. What we saw in that 8-minute and 46-second video was horrific. It did not look compassionate at all, and I think there's definitely some training issues there, without a doubt. But we have to be careful not to allow this to become a narrative that cop killed George Floyd, murdered George Floyd by kneeling on his neck. Because as more evidence comes out, when you see the body cam footage of what was going on before that happened, it's starting to look like that maybe is not the whole story.
Yeah, it's good points, Chuck. And I think people don't want to separate that. There's no question. You can be a rational person and say what they did was inhumane and wrong, but they did not cause his death. I mean, that's a rational position. But people don't want to take one and run with it.
Yeah. Well, look at there was another situation. I don't know what state it happened in, but it was described as this man was unarmed and not resisting arrest, and he was also killed. But the video showed that this man was not only, he took the officer's taser, he was combative, and he was clearly resisting arrest.
Yeah.
And it was determined that, you know, he was on illegal drugs, a father of four, on illegal drugs, sleeping in his car in the middle of a drive-thru. I mean, they wanted the policeman to just take him home so he could sleep it off. Well, how many laws did he break?
Let him go. I mean,
or just let him go.
If they had let him go, he might have driven off and killed somebody else.
Right.
Somebody.
I mean, the policemen in that case were 100% justified by the facts that we know right now. That Rayshard Brooks was a known violent felon. He was at the time high on drugs. He was resisting arrest. He took a policeman's taser and shot one of the police officers with it and attempted to tase the other one as he was attempting to get away. That is a 100% righteous shoot. In any police training manual, by any police policy, that would be a righteous shoot. But again, because of the race of the man that had been shot, that's all. We now have half of Atlanta being burned down, more people being murdered there in vengeance for this. And that is those politics interfere with good law enforcement and cause so much more harm than good.
Well, the way they described it is an unarmed man not resisting arrest was shot by a white law officer. It was like, you didn't watch the same video I watched. There's no way.
But I guarantee you, if the law enforcement officer had been black and the fugitive had been white, it wouldn't have even made the news. And that's where it gets so disgusting, because that is so patently racist on its face. And yet they say that this is all about, you know, systemic racism in the police department. That's a load of horse hockey.
Mike, what do you have to say?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, it's just the narratives that are out there. You know, I keep coming back to the Tucson narrative where, you know, this in-custody death, you know, they jump on, well, this poor man, he was, you know, asking for water. Well, he did not die of thirst, you know. And no one forgets, or everyone leaves out the fact that this man was spitting on the officers when they were trying to take him in custody, to the extent that they had to put a spit hood on him. And this is at the height of the pandemic that this guy is spitting on them, which, by the way, when you have a known drug user and completely, you know, it seemed as he was, as irrational and the symptoms he was showing, you have to assume, if you're a law enforcement officer, that he might be an IV drug user, which carries a whole nother host of horribles with it.
Right.
So you have a spitzhock on the guy to control him spitting things on you, and he's asking for water, and they want him to take the spitzhock off his head and give him a glass of water so he can spit more at them? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And I don't think, you know, some of the people are... I don't think they're thinking logically when they see somebody, oh, I need water or I can't breathe. I mean, guy getting a traffic ticket, he's going to stand there and say, I can't breathe now.
Absolutely.
Just because.
Absolutely right. And that's
the thing to say
and
now.
And it's not just the new thing. I can't tell you how many stops. If you get your typical cop in, you will see when they take someone in custody and they're just handcuffing him behind the back as they're standing, they'll say, I can't breathe.
Yeah.
That's just the most common thing there is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Loosen.
Actually, I have some friends that are cops here in West Virginia that have said, you know, it's really unfortunate that now if they get a call, if they roll up on the call and it looks like it's going to be, you know, an African-American perpetrator or somebody they've got to deal with, they just roll on by. They said, you know what, it's not worth getting my life ruined and going to jail. And so how is this making our community safer?
It's not.
No, not at all.
Not at all. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. We'll be back in a few. Getting a reverse mortgage with the new rules and expanded limits can be a positive, life-changing experience. The reverse offers multiple ways of having your equity work for you, from a monthly income, an interest-bearing equity account, or a total cash out. Give me a call and let's see which reverse option best works for your future plans. Call 520-310-9900. Ask for me, Sherry. That's 520-310-9900.
With monsoon season well underway, the Tucson Fire Department would like you to keep these tips in mind on how to stay safe. Turn around, don't drown. Driving through a mere 8 inches of water can move your vehicle and cause you to be swept away. When thunder roars, head indoors. When you see that lightning flash and hear thunder, you need to drop what you're doing and head inside. When in doubt, wait it out. Save your errands for after storms have passed through your area. Remember, Tucson Fire is here for you. Stay safe.
Law Matters Live Show airs Saturday mornings at 8 when our listeners ask questions of people who have answers. On our next show, Sheriff Mark Napier talks to you about riots, protests, police reform, and the upcoming election. This is your show, Arizona, so get your questions ready to join the talk at 790-2040. You don't want to be left out. Set your alarm for AM 1030 The Voice. And we can't do the show without your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute.
To report suspected human trafficking, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to 233-733. To learn more about Homeland Security investigations and our efforts to combat human trafficking, please visit our website at www.ice.gov or check out the DHS Blue Campaign at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. For more information on the Southern Arizona Anti-Trafficking Unified Response Network, please visit us at www.saturn.org or find us on Facebook.
Thanks for staying with us. Chuck, can you hear us? Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Okay.
Hi.
I just wanted to make sure you're still there.
Still there.
Okay. I know you made a comment about, you know, sometimes if it's a call where there's a black person involved, the police would just drive through. We don't have that situation here in Tucson, do we, Mike?
No, you know, fortunately, we don't have the situation where there's an imbalance of as far as, for instance, white officers patrolling a black community or primarily Hispanic community. Our law enforcement's very diverse, and so it sort of reflects the community where you can't normally, you know, say this is racially based. I've never seen that, even in our most controversial, most recent incident. It didn't seem to be any kind of intimation that this was racially, you know, based or motivated. So I understand that happens in other communities, and there's that, you know, knee-jerk reaction of that's why this happened. But fortunately, we don't have that.
That officer being fired, like, right away. No trial, no investigation. And I know it's not in Arizona, but what do you think is going to happen with that? Is he going to get his job back?
Which one are you talking about?
I think it was in Atlanta.
Oh, that one that Chuck was talking about?
Right.
Right.
Yeah, Rayshard Brooks.
Right. I mean, I think Chuck's dead on with his analysis of that thing where these, you know, will he get his job back? It would only be through some independent commission that he'd appeal to. I don't think any politician is going to look at this and say, look, second, you know, glance at this thing. No one is that brave, or no one has that type of an honor, I don't think.
Backbone.
Yeah.
Would he want his job back is the question.
That's a great point,
That's a thing, too. It's very difficult right now to get anybody to apply for a law enforcement type. I mean, I'm talking all the agencies.
Right. And the way these guys are thrown to the wolves, that they would want to go back to that particular agency. But now this guy's notorious, you know, to find a job in law enforcement – no one will touch this guy, even if they love him, just because the lawyers are going to stand behind the chief and go, you can't afford to have him with this past. So it's such a hard situation because, like the statement you read, unarmed. Well, this, as Chuck pointed out, this guy became armed when he took the taser from these guys. And what they don't understand is, oh, tasers are non-lethal, blah, blah, blah. They incapacitate people. So if he was able to incapacitate one of these officers, what do you think's in play?
Yeah.
They're deadly weapons.
That's right.
And you cannot, as an officer, I used to handle Border Patrol as well, you cannot lose fights. You can't.
Yeah.
It's not an option because then everything you have on your duty belt is at play. I've had...
It seems like the left likes to say, well, then the best thing to do is to make everybody more vulnerable by taking the weapons away from the police or by defunding them altogether, taking the police away altogether. And this is the thing that I don't get. I don't understand about the thought process of the left is that how is it that every time we try to talk about making our community safer, their answer is to make us more vulnerable?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I don't, we don't have that particular movement here, fortunately, as far as, you know, take away their weapons, this and that. There's an ounce of common sense left in this town, I think, but I wouldn't be surprised if that discussion didn't occur.
It doesn't make any sense if the bad guys have better weapons and equipment than the good guys. And if they're going to start coming in with their assault rifles and their shields and their whatever they have, the good guys have to have more of the same. And, you know, it's just not fair to expect our officers to go out on the street ill-equipped.
Well,
yeah, and the problem comes down to, like, rules of engagement, because the police are going to be under very strict and regimented rules of engagement, and we want that. But the criminals have no rules of engagement. And so just like what we saw in Portland and Seattle, where the Antifa guys had the ability to do lasting, permanent physical damage to these officers, and the officers only had non-lethal, temporary crowd control solutions to fight back with.
Yeah, that's wrong. I just feel that's wrong. And so what is the solution? Chuck, what do you see as a solution for this?
Well, the solution to the rioting or to the solution to the problem of defunding the police movement and all that? What are you asking?
Well, the rioting. How are we going to bed?
I've been to a whole lot of these riots, unfortunately, in the last 4 years. It's my least favorite thing to cover. I would much rather charge into a gunfight in Syria against ISIS than to go to these stupid, lame, cowardly little pipe cleaner neck latte drinking skinny jean wearing Antifa dudes throwing water bottles. But the bottom line is the most effective crowd control and the ways that I've seen cops able to break these up was during the Inauguration Day riots in Washington, D.C. And what they did was they brought in overwhelming force. They brought in thousands of cops. And in some cases, you might have to bring in National Guard to have the kind of numbers you need. If you got 3,000 rioters, you're going to need at least 3,000 cops, if not more. And then they were very careful to break these this big group of rioters into smaller groups by pushing them into pushing them in different directions and getting between them and breaking up the groups into smaller, more manageable groups, and then cornering those groups in like one-way streets or dead-end alleys or something like that and arresting every single one of them. In the Inauguration Day riots in Washington, D.C., the D.C. police arrested 1,200 people in one go, and some of those people are still in jail. They charged all of them with felony rioting, and I mean that's serious. So basically they took it seriously. But how are you going to do that in a city that is encouraging the riots? How are you going to do that when the governor and the mayor are on the side of the rioters and the federal government is on its own? That's not really possible. And so I think Trump's answer to basically you've got two choices: you can abandon the federal courthouse down there in Portland or abandon the downtown area of Seattle or the police precincts of Seattle and let them be broken into and looted and burned. That's not going to be a good option. Or you call out overwhelming numbers of federal forces or National Guard, and you go to the mat with these guys and you take them down. And I think the federal government has done what it can to do that in the confines of the regulations that they have to follow, Title 10 and all the stuff like that. And that's just not been a good option because the mayors and governors of those states have not been behind them. But I think that may be changing.
I hope it changes. Something's got to give. Mike, what do you think? What do you think law enforcement should do about protecting themselves, too?
Yeah, I think, Chuck, the one point that resonates to me is when you respond with overwhelming presence, and some people would say force, it deters a lot of action. And you know, when you look at use of force, a lot of people will say, well, you know, that's hitting somebody, striking somebody, shooting somebody. No, the lowest level of force on their force continuum in law enforcement is called officer presence. Mm-hmm. And that's just standing there in a uniform, recognizable. And it's very powerful. And it's non-violent. And literally what Chuck describes, having a massive force there is the lowest form of use of force and yet most effective because it stops the escalation of things.
Here's a question for you, Mike, because you're the lawyer here, and this is something that I keep seeing over and over down there, that these guys put flyers all over, and they have representatives from different organizations that walk around the protest before the riot starts, with phone, handing out cards with phone numbers and saying, if you are arrested, call this number and we will pay to bail you out. They have taken donations to gather funds to pay to get these people out of jail. And so they get arrested and they immediately post bail. They get let out of jail. And the next night they're right back down there protesting again. We see this over and over and over again. Is there a way, this is my question, is there a way the president could maybe sign an executive order or something to say these people who get arrested must be held without bail until their court date or something like that?
I mean, that's unconstitutional. I mean, I get it. You know, it's an abuse of the system and an abuse mm-hmm. of their rights. You know, they're using their rights as a sword rather than as a shield. And so what you're describing, if someone was arrested and they're bailed out the next day and they're arrested again and charged again, at some point these things pile up where, you know, it becomes just daunting on the person to keep getting out there. Now, that's presuming the police and, like you said, the mayor and all these local officials have the stomach to keep enforcing these things.
Right.
But, you know, passing out these things, this is, at some point, the system is going to grind this down if people will just keep to it, you know? But at some point, it's almost like training your dog. You always have to be in charge or they will be a bad dog, right?
That's so true.
You just gotta keep at it, you know? And they're not, people don't have the stomach for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what it comes down to, is that the local governments are complicit. They're in many cases just waiving the fines and just releasing these people. And in the case, I wonder though, because most of the time when these guys get arrested, what they get charged with is trespassing, and it's basically like a parking ticket or a speeding ticket. They have to pay the fine, and then that's it. And so they don't really pile up because, again, they have donations that they use to pay the fines with over and over and over again. I've even done some investigative research into how other organizations like environmental terrorist organizations, extreme environmental terrorists like the Earth Liberation Front, use funds from grants that they get from the EPA to pay their bail when they go do these protests where they chain themselves to a bulldozer or something like that. You know?
There's got to be something wrong with that picture.
taxpayer money. But exactly. The bottom line is they have a large fund there, and they keep paying their tickets, and so that's not really piling up on them. Is there some way that maybe the federal government could charge them? Is that what the...
If they were charged with domestic terrorism, would they be out so quickly?
Exactly.
No?
No, absolutely not. That's a felony, and you know that requires a whole nother level than these misdemeanors Chuck is describing, which, like he says, are just slaps, you know, catch and release.
So I think if they started charging him with domestic terrorism, because it sounds like what they're doing fits the description of domestic terrorism, maybe that would slow things down.
I'll tell you one other thing that I'm seeing down there at these riots that I find very concerning is that as a journalist, when if I'm down there with a press badge on, you know, clearly marked as press, the federal police are not allowed to arrest me for being there. They're not allowed to shoot me with pepper balls and that sort of thing. If I get hit by accident, that's fine. But, you know, we have some sort of immunity just under the Constitution and First Amendment and the freedom of the press. But what I'm seeing is that these Antifa guys are all coming down with press written on their
fake badges,
shields, and on their helmets and everything like that, even though they're clearly not press. They're throwing Molotov cocktails, but they're marked as press in order to try to take refuge behind those First Amendment protections. Are they breaking some other law by doing that? I've wondered about.
Yeah, Mike, would they be in violation of something that they could be arrested for? And
I think, you know, the word press is so loosely defined right now that, you know, they're flying right under the radar with those things. You know, anyone with an Apple an iPhone is press now.
Yeah.
That's too bad, because it sounds like it's a situation that needs to be taken care of.
It makes things more dangerous for me, I promise you that.
I bet.
Do you think this will be handled before the election?
No.
No?
I don't. Okay. Mike?
No, I mean, you know, it's. I've never seen anything like where you just, as you described earlier, Chuck, you know, where there is what's right and wrong, and then there's what's fitting anyone's political agenda. And right now, that's driving every single policy and decision. And so we just can't predict on rational grounds what's going to be happening day to day. And until this stuff resolves itself, you know, meaning the election.
Yeah.
So where are you going next, Chuck, besides on vacation?
Well, I'm working now to try to get into Lebanon to cover this massive explosion that took place last week.
Okay, well, I appreciate you being on the air with us and talking to us and explaining what's happening, because we're certainly not seeing it in the news. And again, those videos are posted on the lawmatters1030.org website. Hit the podcast and scroll down. And I want to thank Mike for giving up your Saturday morning to join us and giving us a legal perspective of what's happening.
My pleasure, Chair.
Next week, we have Sheriff Napier is going to come on and answer all your questions. So get him ready. And until then, we want everybody to stay safe. Stay home, stay healthy, stay tuned. Chuck, you be careful out there, okay?
All right, well, that's the plan.
Okay, thanks for coming on. Thanks for joining us.